Here Be Monsters is a podcast about facing the unknown.
I start to float away from the earth.
Have you ever smoked crack before?
We're all kind of frantically searching for meaning.
They have the neurotransmitters.
I think we're all juggalos in some way.
Yo, we're not broken.
Crazed delinquents.
We're in our last days, young man.
Listen to Here Be Monsters,
the podcast about the unknown,
on the KCRW iTunes page.
From the independent producer project of KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional. Unfictional is a program of true stories and personal documentaries, and today on the program, Thinking of You, three stories about the people we think of when they're not there, or the hope that someone, somewhere, is thinking of you. And if there's a time when you feel like people should be thinking of you, making a little fuss over you, it might be your birthday. But writer Josh Flaum's birthday one year fell on a day when there were much more important things going on. And when someone did call, it was for all the wrong reasons. A quick warning that this story has two very brief descriptions of a grisly murder, so if that might be upsetting to you or to others listening, you might want to skip this one. From KCRW and KCRW.com, it's Unfictional.
The worst thing I ever did took place in Pensacola, Florida. I was going to college there studying marine biology, which I promptly changed to English because I thought when I went to study marine biology that it was going to be all about, you know, looking at the pretty fish. And it turns out it's picking dead seahorses out of a seine net and testing the pH levels of brackish water. So I was there without much direction. I was staying in an apartment off campus, rooming with a girl I was in love with. It was a one-bedroom apartment. Naturally, what that meant is that she was in a comfortable bed with four walls, and I was living on a cot in the living room. 7:30 in the morning, I answered the door, and it is the deputy sheriff of Pensacola. She's got a subpoena, and it's for me. The way subpoenas work, the sheriff has to read a list of rules on the back before she can give it to me. So she starts reading the rules, but then she stops and gives me a look. I'm not sure why, but then I think, oh no, I've left out the bong. She sees the giant purple bong that is directly behind me on the kitchen table. So I start to stretch my body out, blocking it to make sure that she can't see it, but she continues to read the subpoena, and then she stops again, starts to laugh. And now I'm thinking, oh, I've left the pot out too. I mean, I've left the bong and the pot out. She can see it all, and I am going to prison here at 7:30 in the morning. But then she continues to read, then stops again, gives me one more look, laughs for a very long time, then hands me the subpoena, but she won't let go. So we have this brief tug of war. Flashback a couple of months. The campus I went to was the University of West Florida, and there was a terrible murder that happened. It's a woman named Susan Morris, and she was brutally murdered. Her body was found on campus. She had her fingers cut off, her face caved in, and because it was such a small campus, everybody kind of knew this girl. There were vigils, midnight masses, the press was everywhere, and it became this story that hit the national news. Now, it just so happened that they found her body on or around my birthday. So all celebrations were off. Everybody was really sad. People were crying. Now, again, I had all sympathy for Susan Morris and her family, but it was my birthday. So I just decided to get away from the crowd, head upstairs, and wait for my parents to call, which they did every year. Just wanted it to be about me. I wanted them to say happy birthday and ask me birthday questions, you know, like, what are the big plans? So how does it feel to be 20? And I waited for this call. I waited and I waited. Finally, around 9 o'clock, my phone rings. It was my mother. There's a slight pause. I can hear her breathing. Josh? I say, yes. says, I have a question to ask you, and I want you to tell me the truth. I said, okay. And I want you to know that you can tell me, and I'll love you no matter what. And I said, okay. She said, did you kill that girl on campus? I said, what? Did you kill that girl on campus? Did you do it? I said, no. She said, are you sure? Am I sure? This is a girl whose face was caved in, her fingers were cut off. This is the nature of the crime that she's asking me if I committed. So I say, no, I did not. Okay, but if you did, you know I'd love you just the same. I just really need to know. No, Mom, I did not kill that girl. She said, okay. Long pause. Then she said, Josh? I said, yes. Are you gay? Am I gay? What? No, I'm not gay. Are you sure? Yes, because you know if you were gay, I'd love you just the same. I just really need to know. Well, I'm sure I'm not gay, and I didn't kill that girl on campus. What is this all about? And she said, well, you know, it was raining, and I just got to thinking, you just keep to yourself. You're so quiet, and, you know, you're 20 years old. You haven't had a girlfriend. And this is true. I, in fact, didn't have a girlfriend to the age of 26. The truth is, at the time, I was terrified of women. I wonder why that could be. And so, I said, you can be assured, I didn't murder that girl. I'm not gay. Is there anything else? She mumbled something about insurance forms, but then hung up in a sort of embarrassment, and that was it. That was the phone conversation. That was my 20th birthday. So now, flash forward to Deputy Sheriff of Pensacola. I'm in a tug of war over a subpoena. And the reason I'm getting the subpoena is I'm actually a material witness to this entire murder. It turns out I was up all night. The killer stayed in my dorm and actually slept with a girl in my co-ed dorm after he murdered Susan Morris. I saw him, I talked to him, and I also saw him drive away in what turned out to be the victim's car, which he had stolen after the fact. That's why I was being subpoenaed to court to point the finger at the murderer, Eric Scott Branch. So I'm in this tug of war with the deputy sheriff of Pensacola, who is laughing at me and not saying why. Finally, she releases the subpoena, looks at me, shakes her head, and leaves. It's so early in the morning. So I closed the door and I felt the breeze. And that right there is the worst thing I have ever done in my entire life. I had exposed myself to the deputy sheriff of Pensacola.
Josh Flaum is a writer and performer based in Los Angeles. I'm Bob Carlson, and from KCRW and KCRW.com, it's Unfictional. And today on the program, Thinking of You. Next is a story by producer Sarah Brooke Curtis. She spent her days walking around alone, thinking of someone who wasn't there. Then, finally, she finds an unlikely audience to share her thoughts with. By the way, since we first broadcast this story, the producer Sarah Brooke Curtis was awarded a Gracie Award from the Alliance for Women in Media Foundation. From KCRW.com, it's Unfictional and Ask Me.
Three nights in a row, I have the same bus driver, and three nights in a row, I needed her. The first night, I've been walking on the beach the way that I do lately. First, walking really fast, faster than my mind can move. Into my body, out of my mind, that fast. Walking so fast that people are probably looking at me and wondering what it is I'm running from. Then once I get to this certain point on the beach and can feel and hear my heart pumping, my cheeks get all warm and rosy and I slow down and begin looking around at all of the shapes gathered in the sand.
Wow, the bird is tiger.
all the beautiful and sad things around me.
So many sad things.
Half-buried dead birds, chipped sand dollars, slimy seaweed wound in circles, crushed crab shells.
Smells like fire.
Half-burnt pages of a novel fanned around some gangly pieces of charred up firewood. Plastic bags wrapped around seashell-studded rope. Purple birthday ribbon knotted up with pokey pelican feathers. Fishing poles reaching out to sea at all the right angles, and more of those dead birds. Picked apart skeletons and decomposing limbs splayed out like they were in the middle of some tragic mating dance. I follow matted down feather trails, layered in the footprints of a large man's shoe. There are so many perfect accidental arrangements of things. I see little stories written all over this beach and I keep track of them. Winding my way around these things, magnetized by some invisible labyrinth, like I'm sleuthing out the scene of a series of little crimes and victories. I watch all the strangers, and I'm especially curious about those that walk alone like me. When they're old and a little hunched, I imagine they are recently widowed, walking while the sun goes down to avoid an unfamiliar stretch of dinnertime loneliness. I listen to couples, laughing in little heaps surrounded by an empty bottle of Prosecco and strewn off hoodies. I listen to babies crying in baby carriers clutched so closely to their parents' heart. I stomp on dried up crab shells because I like this satisfying sound they make and it reminds me a little bit of heartbreak. I look out at the ocean waves mounting and crashing and sputtering. Some days I just stare at the foam lapped up on the shore and puffs just jiggling in the breeze. Where does that foam come from anyways, and why does it look like a dirty dog bath? After a while, the waves sound fuzzy and throbbing. My ears get a little cold and I wrap my head in a scarf. I pick up a piece of crusty, hardened seaweed to scratch my daughter's name into the wet sand, deep enough for each letter to well up like a little moat. My nose drips and my hair gets tangly and wild in my face. I watch the sun start to go down.
I see you everywhere.
When I see purple, when I see red, or when it's just unfathomably and intensely perfect, I see her.
Sweetheart, I see you.
Sometimes I twirl around, delighted by the insane beauty and predictability of the sun setting over the Pacific Ocean. I look all around me and hope to God that other people who are going through this are seeing the sunset over the ocean too. If you are, please go. I promise you it will help. Okay, back to the bus driver and that first night. So I had to pee and was hungry for dinner, and there was a bus leaving in 4 minutes and not another one for a half hour. And I was ways away, so I just kind of gave up and sauntered back, thinking I would have to catch the later one. But when I climbed up over the dune, the bus was just sitting there, like it was waiting just for me. That first night, the bus driver was on her phone, looking out at the ocean, tracing circles on the pavement with her brightly colored Pumas. When she was ready to go, I stepped my sandy feet onto the bus, and we were the only ones on there. I sat towards the back, feeling kind of shy, and though we couldn't see each other, I felt just connected to her, like we were old friends headed out on a long drive. I told her how electric pink the sunset was and how glittery the ocean looked. She told me that she liked to throw her worries into the waves, and when she does so, she feels connected to everyone and everything. She then laughed this slow, soft laugh, as if bemused by the abstraction in her thinking and the very fact that she was sharing her thinking with a stranger. I decided not to habitually press my earbuds into my ears this time, and instead listen to her voice, be open to some kind of connection. We talked about how the ocean puts everything into perspective and makes us feel small but full. That first night, I just wanted to tell her everything about me. We had two stops alone before anyone got on. But at the next stop, people began filling the bus. I was a little sad and a little relieved. Our conversation switched to baseball and the Giants being in the playoffs and if she thought the Royals were going to make a comeback. I wanted her to ask me about my life. I wanted to turn just like inside out on the bus. When I get off at my stop, I leave from the front door because I want to make eye contact with her and just say thank you. So that's what I do. The second night, when I hiked up over the dune, the bus that was supposed to have left long before was still there. And yes, it was the same bus driver. She welcomed me on. She started telling me about her life. She told me about her trip to Paris last year and how her husband loves to take pictures and has a good eye for angles. It kind of didn't matter what she said because her voice was just so calming to me. I felt like curling up on the seat and just purring like a damn cat. I was holding this heart-shaped rock that washed up at my feet. I don't mean one of those rocks that vaguely could be a heart if you wanted it to be. I mean a perfect, smooth heart just washed up at my feet. So perfect that I looked around and felt strongly like someone had to have planted it there just for me to find. So on the second night in a row, I'm listening to this bus driver and just moving the heart-shaped rock back and forth between my hands as she talks. Again, no one gets on the bus for two stops, and I hope she will ask me about my life. I hope she will ask me if I'm a parent. I want so much to be able to say, yes, I am a mother just like you. I want to tell her that despite what she sees, I am totally transformed and I just need to tell someone. This is not a dream. I need to tell her. Then eventually people start getting on the bus again, teenagers, nurses, middle-aged zookeeper with braces, a girl who just keeps counting and counting. So this time when I get off the bus, I decide to show her my rock, like a kid showing off her missing first tooth. And she just got this huge smile on her face and said, "Oh, that is beautiful. You are so lucky." I laughed a little like, yeah, maybe I am lucky in the moment. So the third night, the bus was waiting there again, and yes, it was her with her brightly colored pumas. She was standing outside the bus watching the last little bit of sun seep into the ocean, and I was doing the same. My back was to her, and we were both just looking out over the horizon, feet deep in the sand. Eventually, I heard her start up the bus, open the doors, and say, "Are you ready? Come on in." I awkwardly ran towards her in slow motion, in that way you do when trying to push your limbs through sand uphill. I decided to sit in one of those side seats that face the driver, that only the talkers usually sit in, you know those seats? It was just us again. She told me that right before I showed her my heart-shaped rock the night before, she had been thinking about how much God loves us and how God is so good and how she has so much to be grateful for. She told me how the timing of her thoughts with my shared heart-shaped rock was perfect, just another example of God's love. She asks me how long I've lived in the Bay Area. I tell her 8 years, and she recognizes that I must really like it if I've lived here that long. I tell her, yes, I do, but my family is mostly all on the East Coast and I miss them dearly. I'm thinking, yes, we're talking about family. Just ask me, please ask me, dearest God-loving bus driver. And then eventually people start filling up the bus and we go back to discussing the Giants and if we think they're going to win the World Series that night, and we start imagining the different types of crazy that the city will become depending on the outcome. And then when we were half a block from my stop, she asks, "So do you have any kids?" I get chills, and I stand up and hold onto the pole and get close to her and say, "Well, yes,
I mean, I had a baby girl at the end of August, but she was born terminally ill, and she died 3 days later. And I know that's a lot to put on you, and that you're just my bus driver. I know I have to get off the bus because it's my stop, and this is a lot, but that's why I've been walking the beach at night and savoring the sunsets like it's my lifeline. And she looked me in the eyes and said, "You're going to be okay. God loves you. Yes, it is a lot, but you're going to be okay. I'll be seeing you soon, you hear?" And I say okay, and thank you so much. And I get off the bus and let out this huge sigh. And she just like honks her way down the hill. And you see, she wasn't saying it in that dreaded, "It's all in God's plan" kind of a way. No mother grieving the loss of her child wants to hear that. I really felt like she believed I was going to be okay, and that the God she believed in believed that too. And I believed in her, so I was entirely grateful. I still go to the beach almost every single night, but I haven't seen her since.
Sarah Brooke Curtis is a radio producer based in the San Francisco Bay Area. Editorial help for that piece was provided by Leela Day. Additional mixing by Nick White. I'm Bob Carlson, and from KCRW.com, it's Unfictional. Today on the program, Thinking of You. And we close with one from storyteller Madison Perry about how a family changes over time, you know, like people do, and how we try to remember them the way they used to be. On KCRW.com, it's Unfictional.
There is a 60-mile stretch of I-25 in Colorado that I have driven more than any other road on this planet. A highway between where my mom lived in Fort Collins, Colorado, and where my dad lived in Denver. My parents got divorced when I was about 5 years old, and I have a little sister who's 3 years younger. Both my parents were great parents, loving parents, but there always had to be a distance between them because they did not get along at all. A lot of those drives started or ended with fights about who was late, who was supposed to pick us up next time. And there's a very strange feeling when you're a kid that you know neither parent is mad at you, but it still makes you feel horrible to know that the two people you love most in the world hate each other, that they cannot get along. It just almost doesn't make logical sense to you. Whenever there was a fight going on, we would go into some other room together and I would try and make my sister laugh. So we ended up driving on this road dozens of times a year. And the worst part was that it required my parents to talk to each other to figure out when they would drop off or pick up or if there's any alterations. So oftentimes the drives would be filled with diatribes against one or the other of the parents. So when I turned 16, I took over the driving, and I loved that because we could just go when we wanted. I'd drive my sister, and we didn't have to worry about my parents interacting. After college, I was living back in my hometown, and we still made this drive all the time. We were driving down the highway, and it was a pretty trafficy day. And I was passing someone, and while I was in their blind spot, they started to merge over into my lane. And my sister yelled, "Look out!" I jammed the wheel away from the car, and I almost went off the highway, and I swerved back the other way and almost went into the traffic lane next to me and swerved again, and I lost control. And suddenly, just in the snap of a finger, I went from like singing along to the radio to going into the median of the highway at about 40 or 50 miles per hour. I had a distinct thought of, oh, this is what a bad car accident looks like. I'm about to be in a bad car accident. I see that we're gonna go into these other lanes of traffic, and I think that would be bad. And I yanked the wheel one more time, and we rolled the truck three times. Happened in a snap, I felt my head hit the top of the car, and we came to a stop, and the world was sideways. It had stopped on the passenger side door. I opened my eyes and I literally thought, I'm alive. I cannot believe I'm alive. The engine was still running. I had to put it into park and turn it off. I climbed out the top of the vehicle, jumped down, and I looked myself over. Nothing hurt. There was no blood on me. And my sister was not as lucky as I. She was unconscious in the passenger seat. Came to about, 2 minutes later. So they loaded my sister onto the ambulance, and they said, you can ride in the back. And of course, my sister wanted me to, and I sat down beside her and took her hand. And the paramedic asked me, is there any medical condition that your sister has that we should know about? And very just quickly, really without even thinking, I said, well, she's really short. You should know that she's a very short person. And she laughed. And then she said, don't make me laugh. That really hurt. But you could tell it made her feel a little bit better, that if I was joking around, maybe this was going to be okay. So we rode to the hospital, and both my parents got there. And when they first walked into the hospital, one of my first thoughts was like, oh no, my parents are together. Are they going to get in a fight? What's going to happen? My sister was getting x-rays, and they just came and hugged me and asked how Caitlin was. And it was a bit, even in the moment I realized, it was a bit strange to have both parents consoling me at the same time. And it was the first time that they had been in the same room together and sat that close since I could remember. My sister ended up being in the hospital for probably about 36 hours. She just needed rest and to heal. So the next morning, I went back to the hospital to see my sister. Both my parents were still there, and they'd stayed the whole night together. And there was no visible evidence of a physical altercation in my sister's hospital room. And my sister, we had a moment alone, and she told me that they had sat next to each other all night, and Caitlin had heard them talking and crying and apologizing for a lot of things. Over the years, it really did feel like at that moment, their love for my sister was stronger than any of the personal hatred they had for each other. I remember in the drive home from the hospital when we were taking my sister home, and I think I made a joke to my mom, like, oh, that's the longest you've spent with Dad in a while. She laughed, but she kind of said, yeah. And they didn't become best friends or get back together or anything like that, but they could be around each other again. The last couple years, we've had Thanksgiving with the whole family for the first time in a long time, and it was nice to have a holiday where we didn't have to immediately then drive 60 miles to someone else's house to have a holiday.
Madison Perry is a writer and storyteller here in Los Angeles. You can find photos of all the people in these stories and other information at our website, kcrw.com/unfictional, where you can also find an archive of all the past episodes of this program. I'm Bob Carlson, producer of Unfictional. The associate producer is Nick White. You can podcast this show on iTunes or however you like to hear podcasts. Follow us on Twitter, @Unfictional. Like us on Facebook. I'm Bob Carlson, and I hope you'll join me next time for Unfictional from KCRW.com.